Let's open with a word of prayer. Lord, you have brought us safely through the night to this new day to know you and praise you and serve you. We thank you for gathering us in your church. We pray that what we learn this day might deepen our commitment to understanding and reconciliation. This we bring to you in Christ's name. Amen. I'm pleased to be back for our second session. We'll have four altogether, so still a couple of weeks to come. And today we're going to focus particularly on this figure, this man, whom you probably recognize. This is President Vladimir Putin, who has been the leader of Russia since 2000. So we want to understand him, his motivations, why he's so often in the news. But let me first say a word about how I got interested in Russia. Because I am a theologian, I am not a historian, I did not major in Russian in college. As I mentioned last week, my first Russian lessons came at the University of Pittsburgh when I was 48 years old. And that stretched my mind, trying to keep up with those 18 and 19-year-olds who would come in Monday morning dragging, having been out over the weekend partying, while the old man was studying his flashcards and trying to catch up. I'm sorry? Just till Monday. By Tuesday, I was behind again. Yes, so. Well, it's a long story, but I will make it short by saying that my first interest in that part of the world was in Eastern Germany, when it was still a communist country, and I had an unusual opportunity through the National Council of Churches to spend a year as a guest student at a Lutheran seminary in East Berlin when East Berlin was still communist. This got me curious about that part of the world. Of course, East Germany at that time was under the domination of the Soviet Union. Wherever I would walk, I would see Russian soldiers. And of course, for a young man who had grown up in the time of the Cold War, this was both a bit eerie, but also fascinating. Who are these people who are supposedly my enemy? So that's the short version of the story that eventually led then to stays in Russia beginning in 2004. And so over almost 15 years now, I've been going back and forth to Russia. I've had several longer stays there. And have tried to understand, who are these people? Why do they think in the way that they do? What are their motivations? And why is it that we again find our two nations at a time of impasse, of misunderstanding? There are items almost every day now in the news about retaliatory measures between our two countries. In fact, this past week, I just heard that the Russian government eliminated the special parking spaces reserved for diplomats in St. Petersburg. So there you go. No more parking spots for those Russians. They've got to pay the meter like the rest of us do. Or for the Americans, they don't get... They've got to plug the meter like the rest of the Russians do. So that starts to seem pretty petty, but reminds us of other times in our troubled relationship between our two nations. So what I want to talk about today, as I say, is President Putin, what motivates him, why he's become so popular. And having referred to East Germany, I have to tell you that I almost crossed paths with President Putin when he was still a lowly KGB agent, and when he was stationed in Dresden, East Germany. My wife and I and a group from our church in Nebraska happened to be in East Germany in early November 1989. We had a partner congregation close to Dresden. They were celebrating an anniversary. They had invited a group from our church to come visit them. And so on November 5th, 1989, our friends from the church in Dresden invited us to go march with the pro-democracy demonstrators through downtown Dresden. And there we were holding candles and marching with 100,000 other East Germans through the streets of Dresden calling for democracy. About two blocks away from where we marched were the KGB offices. And as we marched by, we read later that President Putin that very evening was shredding and destroying documents. Because on November 9th, 4 days later, the Berlin Wall came down while we were still in East Germany. So we got within two blocks of each other, and I think that's the closest we've ever come ever since. I've never been in the same room with President Putin, but I can say I've now been in the room with people who had been in the room with President Putin. So just by a through intermediaries, so I guess that's as close as we've come. As I said last week when we were talking about the long-term effects of the Bolshevik Revolution, Russians don't like revolutions. Americans idealize revolution. We had a successful revolution. We celebrate our revolution. 100 years after the Bolshevik Revolution, Russians do not celebrate what happened in 1917 because for them, revolution represents chaos and a lack of identity. Who are we? What are we as a nation? Where do we belong? These are the questions that the revolution left in its wake. A sense of chaos, instability, and a lack of clear identity. And this is exactly what President Putin has been so successful in responding to. He's very popular. He continues to have approval ratings of over 80% because of those two items. He has brought Russian stability, and he has given them a sense of identity, a sense of national pride. Yes?
Well, could you trust those surveys? I mean, if he's throwing the survey, it might be biased.
You know, that's a really good question. How much can we trust surveys in Russia or really anywhere in the world? But they're probably pretty accurate, although I would say most Russians, their attitude toward politics is pretty cynical. So we like Putin only because that's the only real option that we have. So I think it's a good question. That popularity is not necessarily very deep. It's what you say to the person who asks you, but not necessarily reflective of a deeper loyalty to Putin. But he has brought stability, and people like that. It's been a time of economic prosperity, and he has given Russians, again, a sense of national pride. So let's talk about this man, who he is, how he has interacted with American leaders, and let's begin with just a little bit of his biography. He was born in 1952 in St. Petersburg, at that time called Leningrad. And he was born into a very humble family. His father was a factory worker. His mother picked up odd jobs. And they lived in a communal apartment. I don't know if that's something that you've heard of or can imagine, but This was a Soviet idea to promote solidarity. So you have to think about your house, where each room would be taken and given to a separate family. So the living room would belong to one family, the dining room to another family, the separate bedrooms to separate families. And then they would share the bathrooms and the kitchens. Now, I don't know about your family system, but we find this hard enough to do with our kids, let alone with strangers and other families. But this was very common during the Soviet period. So he lived in a communal apartment, and the conditions were quite uncomfortable. St. Petersburg is built on a swamp, and so you deal with things like mosquitoes and rats. And basically, he grew up in a rather poor working class family. His father was not religious. His mother was more religious. She had him baptized as a baby. But they kept no icons at home. There was no religious life within the family, in part because the mother did not want to cause problems for her husband. And so President Putin did not grow up with a religious upbringing, although he to this day identifies himself as a Christian, as an Orthodox. There's a funny story about this. In the Orthodox tradition, when you're baptized as a typically as an infant, you're also given a cross that you wear around your neck on a chain. And this is the symbol of your baptismal identity, and typically Orthodox people will wear that for the rest of their lives. But in Putin's case, his mother never gave him his cross until much later in life. He was already an adult. He was already president of the Russian Federation, and he was getting ready to make a trip to Israel as a state dignitary, and his mother found the cross and gave it to him. And so here is President Putin enjoying some vacation, and he's got the cross around his neck. Well, we may want to ask later, is he really a Christian? That's a difficult question whenever you talk about political leaders. But he does identify himself as an Orthodox Christian. As I said, his first assignment after university, after KGB school, was to East Germany. When the wall fell in 1989, he returned to Leningrad. He worked in the city administration there. He was mostly behind the scenes, but was very effective, was known for his diligent work. Eventually, he was attracted to Moscow. And in 1989, President Yeltsin took note of Putin and decided that Putin should be his successor. Now, this was an interesting time for President Putin to come to power then, in the following year, the year 2000, as Yeltsin left the political stage. Because the 1990s in Russia were a very turbulent time. We think of it as a time of democratization, opening up to the West, with the fall of communism in 1991, the fall of the Soviet Union at that time, just 2 years after the Berlin Wall fell. And so from a Western perspective, this looked promising, that Russia could be our friend. But for most Russians, the 1990s were not a good decade. There was runaway inflation. In 1998, the ruble crashed, and most people lost their life savings. I know friends in Russia who during that decade would go to the market and could find practically nothing to eat. They couldn't buy tea or coffee. And so they drank herbal tea during that period. I have a friend who one day went to the market and he found one egg for sale that he was able to grab. And he practically danced home with that egg on the tip of his fingers because it had been such a wonderful discovery. So the 1990s were very difficult. It was also a turbulent time politically. There was the war in Afghanistan, which was the Soviet Union's, Russia's Vietnam. And people on pensions, especially older people, had very limited pensions. People were living on $100, $150 a month. You would go to the metro station, you'd go to the train stations, and you'd see elderly people selling their heirlooms. And sometimes not even that much. Old magazines and books and dollies and things that they had collected over the years. President Yeltsin was not popular. To us, he looked like a democratic figure, even though we knew that he drank too much vodka and could stumble around in front of an audience, but he was very unpopular because what did the 1990s represent? Instability, chaos, and no clear identity, nothing to be proud about. Russians felt humiliated. And maybe this is true of every nation, but it's not good for a country to feel humiliated. And whether it's true or not, and a lot of it is not true, but Russians came to feel that they were being humiliated by the West because the West had supported the fall of communism. The West had supported President Yeltsin. The West had sent advisors about how to liberalize the economy. And so the West came to be seen as wanting to rub the nose of Russia in the dust. In the 1990s, the GNP of Russia, a country of 140 million people, once one of the superpowers of the world, the GNP in the mid-1990s was no more than the GNP of Denmark, which has 12 million people. So Russians went through this time of feeling humiliated. And President Putin has succeeded over the last 16 years of making Russians feel proud again about their distinctive identity, and he has given them economic prosperity. Now, some of the economic prosperity has been related to until recently, high oil prices. So when a decade ago, until the crash of 2008, when oil was $100, $110, even $120 a barrel. This was very beneficial to the Russians. Since then, with the collapse of the oil prices, the economy's had a rougher ride in Russia. We'll talk about this. But for the most part, under President Putin, there's been economic gain. Every year, people have seen things getting better. And if you were to go to Moscow, you would be amazed at what a world-class city Moscow has become. The effort to recreate Moscow to rival Paris or London or New York City. And the metro system in Moscow has to be one of the best subway systems in the world. I'm always a little bit embarrassed when I go to New York City and, you know, I'm coming from abroad, I get off at Kennedy Airport and then head into Manhattan on the subway. You know, the New York subway is efficient, but it's dirty, it's dark, it's crowded. The Moscow metro system is gorgeous, light, clean, efficient. During rush hour, the trains run every 20 to 30 seconds. Every year now, new metro stations are being opened. During the Stalin era, Stalin saw the metro also as the pride of Moscow. And if you've ever been to Moscow, you know that the metro stations there were pieces of art with sculptures and stained glass and a display to the world of the beauty that even a metro system could have. So the metro system continues to expand. Building continues to take place. New apartments, a new sense of customer service, things that indeed have propelled Russia into the 21st century. Economic stability, political stability, Putin has been able to deliver. But also this question of identity. President Putin has given Russians the confidence again that they are a great empire. We think of the end of empires, that the imperial age ended 100 years ago, but Russians still think in imperial terms. From their point of view, the world is divided into spheres of influence. Spheres of empire. China, the United States, perhaps Western Europe, Russia. These are the great empires of the 21st century. And we think of the political scene in a different way. We think of national identities and have supported the creation of new nations. But Russians think in terms of empire. And given the immensity of Russia, perhaps geographically it's no surprise that Russians think of themselves again as a great empire. You've probably read this somewhere. How many time zones across Russia? 11. 11 time zones. From
so half the world.
Half the world, practically. Okay. Largest nation in the world geographically. Unlimited natural resources. Incredible potential. And you can see that it borders on important nations, not only Western Europe, but also to the south, the Central Asian republics that used to be part of the Soviet Union, and all the way practically to Japan, with a long border with China, Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq nearby. Russians think of themselves as a great empire with a sphere of influence. This helps to explain why, under President Putin, Russia has been aggressive in places like Ukraine. Because from a Russian way of thinking, Ukraine belongs to the same civilization, the same empire as the Russian Federation. To lose Ukraine is to lose part of its empire. President Putin once said that the greatest geopolitical calamity of the 20th century was the breakup of the Soviet Union. And we hear that and hear it as he's idealizing the Soviet Union. He's an old communist. He's not for democracy. But the way Russians hear that is he cares about our imperial identity. Ukraine should be under our influence, not Western influence, say Russians. Russian interests in the Middle East, particularly in Syria, where there's a large Orthodox Christian population. 10% of Syria under Assad was Christian, was Orthodox, the same orthodoxy that Russians embrace. And so, again, that should be, say, Russians within our sphere of influence. And that has led to a new sense of assertiveness, aggression, misunderstandings with the West, and particularly the United States. Because from a Russian point of view, from President Putin's point of view, the United States wants hegemony over the entire world. The United States wants no political rival. And Russians have said, we're going to be a rival again. We're not just a second-rate European nation like Denmark. We are a great empire. We still have nuclear weapons. We still have a sphere of influence. We are still great. We are not just under the West. The past three presidents of the United States all thought initially that they could make President Putin their friend. George W. Bush once said he looked into Vladimir Putin's eyes and he could see that they understood each other. President Barack Obama had the reset button. We'll reset our relations with Russia and President Putin. And President Trump came to power, perhaps with the help of the Russians, certainly being friendly with the Russians, seeing Russia as a potential ally. And in all three cases, relations have only gotten worse. You can look into President Putin's eyes, but that doesn't mean that he's going to be your friend. You can hit reset buttons, but he will look out for Russian interests. And Russian interests are to be regarded as empire and to be taken seriously as an empire. Part of this imperial thinking also has to do, again, with geography from a different point of view. We alluded to this last week. Russia, this immense land, to the west and the south, does not have many natural borders. And this means that Russia, over its, well, if you take the predecessor nation, empire called Rus, for 1,000 years, Russia has been susceptible to invasions. It doesn't have rivers and mountains and has only the ocean on the one side. It's been susceptible to invasions. First invasions in the Middle Ages from the Mongolians. Then in 1812, the invasion of Napoleon. In 1941, the Hitler-German invasion. A great empire, but an empire that has often suffered. And part of the distinctive imperial identity of Russia today is that we can suffer and come out victorious. This is part of our national identity, that we can suffer, but we pull together. We beat the Mongols and became a great empire. We beat the French and continue to be a great European power. We beat the Nazis at the price of 28 million Soviet citizens who died in World War II, and we came out as one of the great superpowers of the world. So what are the prospects for the future? I'll say a couple of words and then open it up for some discussion. Well, we've already said that the economic situation now is more difficult. After a decade of magnificent, quick growth in the economic standard, now a slowdown due to lower oil prices and Western sanctions. Russians are having to dig in. The value of the ruble has declined by 50%. So people are no longer enjoying the high life. Although you go to Moscow and you would never notice it. There are coffee bars everywhere, new restaurants. Still appears to be a very prosperous city. But what will this mean? Will the economic downturn then work against President Putin? Will there be discontent? Will people say, you violated the deal. We said we would be quiet politically if you would deliver economically. What will happen if the economy continues to be stagnant? In fact, last year there was actually a slight decline in the GNP. And Russians are worried. Russians are worried about what the next years will bring. But so far, while Russians are not entirely happy with President Putin's management of the economy, they are happy about his international policies. They wildly supported the annexation of Crimea. They've been supportive of Russian support for the rebels in eastern Ukraine, supportive of Russian intervention in Syria, supportive of Putin standing up to American presidents. This sense of pride and empire that we are a distinctive civilization, this still makes President Putin popular as a world leader who can compete with the others. Next week, we're going to turn to the way that the Orthodox Church has provided a narrative for President Putin, a narrative of empire and the distinctiveness of the Russian people and the Russian civilization. We'll hold that for next week, but it's an important part of the story, the way that Christianity in its Orthodox form in Russia has also been part of this resurgence of Russian pride, Russian empire, Russian identity. So let me stop there for a moment and see what questions or observations you all have.
Can you talk a little bit about the distribution of the wealth or the loss of wealth?
Yes, okay. One of the things that happened in the 1990s as the economy was liberalized under the influence of Western advisors. There was a group of people who emerged who are called the oligarchs. These were people who had connections to Yeltsin, and they were able to buy up state resources, state properties at very low prices. The gas industry, steel, pipelines. Much of the Russian economy is in the hands of a few very, very wealthy business people. And President Putin actually initially won some popularity by giving the impression that he was going to take on the oligarchs. And there was one famous trial, one oil oligarch that he took on, Khodorkovsky. He was put in prison. He's now exiled to the West. So this made Putin very popular, that he was speaking out for the common person, that he was going to take on these oligarchs who had ripped off the rest of the Russian people, because you have these very, very wealthy people and then these people on pensions selling whatever they have left. That kind of gap between rich and poor. Putin became popular for appearing to take that on, but the pattern really hasn't changed. Putin himself has very close connections to all of the oligarchs. What he did manage, is it him or just because of the high oil prices in the early 2000s? There is much more of a middle class in Moscow and St. Petersburg. So this big gap in wealth, the very rich, the very poor, who are especially the elderly, a growing middle class, especially in the big cities, a big gap between the cities and the countryside. So Moscow, prosperous, glittering, glistening, new apartment buildings, new skyscrapers and businesses, but smaller towns in the countryside, 20, 30,000 people, often are losing their young people. There's no work. Agriculture has collapsed in many parts of the country, so there's been this huge movement into Moscow. Young people go to Moscow to find work because in the countryside there's nothing. Yes?
Would you discuss birth rates and its threat on the GDP?
I'm sorry, the...
Birth rates and its threat on economic growth?
Fur trade?
Birth rates.
Wait, I'm still not quite connecting.
Well, the rate at which people are being...
Birth rate. Sorry. Sorry, okay. Yes, okay. So until about 2012, there was a rapidly declining birth rate. Russia was one of the few European countries, say if you look at Western Europe, where birth rates were such that the population was declining. That was also true in Germany. And it's fairly flat in the rest of Western Europe, but it was declining dramatically in Russia. With the turnaround in the economy and the growth of a middle class, there now is a better rate. It's close to replacement rate now in Russia. So there has been something of a rebound. Whether that will continue, we don't know. But the demographics have not been good. The other demographic reality is that Russia is a multicultural empire. It's a multicultural nation. It has many Islamic peoples, traditionally Muslim peoples. And in Russia, the Muslims and many immigrants, many illegal out of the Central Asian republics, have come to work in Russia, just as we have Hispanics who have come to the United States. And in a similar way, this part of the population is growing much more rapidly than ethnic Russians. And so there are issues of racism, concerns about Muslim growth, what that means for Russia's identity into the future.
How would you compare the wealth gap between the top and everybody else in Russia versus here?
Well, it would be comparable to the United States, except that the United States has a larger middle class. But if you're looking at the absolute gap, it would be, sure, you know. I mean, how do you put together Bill Gates and a mother living on welfare in Homewood, right? You know, that kind of gap is present probably in many parts of the world. But there's a much larger middle class in Russia.
Where did that come from? How did that get created?
That was created largely because of the new economic prosperity under President Putin. So people who were able to save enough money to start a business, the growth of larger businesses and industries, not just the traditional hard industry like steel and coal, but the kind of transformation that's taken place in other parts of the world. Some of that got started in Russia. So, yes?
What's the quality of their consumer goods? Back in the 70s, when the Russian gymnastic team was touring the country with Olga Korbut, it was so popular, and I bought my daughter an Olga Korbut t-shirt. I bought my son a latex t-shirt, and he wore that for years. But is there good stuff? Any good?
Well, you go to... So, I mean, there are two ways to answer that. One is, in a city like Moscow, everything's available. It's all a question of how much money you have. But the general quality of goods is quite good, quite high. Very different than the Soviet period. So, again, a prosperous society that wants a good standard of living. People want apartments that have been renovated. They want nice clothes. Russians typically dress very nicely when they go out on the streets in a big city like Moscow, much more stylish than a lot of young Americans today. And so consumer quality, consumer goods has gotten much higher. Consumer service has gotten much better. Many more people speaking English and helping tourists. You know, it used to be that you would go to Russia, and if you went into a shop and asked for help, you'd just get a sour look. And the last time I went into a store, a young man came up to me and said in perfect English, I must look American. I hadn't even opened my mouth. And he asked if he could help me. This would have been unimaginable even 5 or 6 years ago. So this growth in a consumer mentality, consumer culture, consumer expectations has advanced quite dramatically over what it was a decade ago. But for people who have less money, as in any place in the world, there are alternatives, less quality, less expensive. Many, many things that are imported from China, from Central Asia, knockoff trademarks, you know, so you can buy New Balance shoes in Moscow at a outdoor market for $30, but they're not going to be New Balance shoes. So it's different sides of the economy, the official economy and the black market, underground economy.
That's sort of like New York.
Sort of like New York, yes. Watch out for the guy who says, I've got these watches for sale. Yes? Well, he's been cautious about North Korea, President Putin. He has said that so far he's not going to cut off oil exports to North Korea. I think he's concerned about North Korea, but you know, the Russian strategy, the Russian attitude, as I've tried to portray it this morning, is you got to talk to us. This will not be decided by the United States alone. We're going to be a player, whether they should be or not, but that's always the attitude. So I think that's what President Putin is doing. He's posturing to have influence in any decisions made about North Korea.
Hmm? What about drugs and crime?
One of the things that happened with the fall of the Soviet Union was it was much easier to travel. It's much easier to get across borders. And this is good for Russians. They can now travel. They have freedom of travel, much more than they've ever had at any time in the last 100 years. And Russians go on vacation to Turkey and Egypt and Israel and Germany. Although now with the economic problems, there's less travel. But they can get the visas, they can get the permission. That's not the problem. But the opening of borders also has other effects. And many more elderly Russians will complain about this, the influx of pornography. Influx of drugs. And so the addiction rates to opioids in Russia is the highest in Europe. About 1.5% of men between 20 and 60 are addicted to heroin or some other opioid. So it's been a massive public health crisis in Russia. And it's not unusual when we lived there, we would occasionally, not every day, but we would occasionally see people strung out on heroin, sitting on the sidewalk, spaced out, not moving. We'll talk more about this next week, but the church has taken an important lead in trying to develop drug rehabilitation programs. But there's not enough for the massive crisis. This also means that HIV/AIDS has been a growing challenge for Russia. Again, has challenged Russians to respond to those new problems.
What about healthcare in general there?
Yes, well, we were, last week someone mentioned that the situation in the 1990s when the healthcare system had collapsed with the fall of the Soviet Union. In the 1990s, it was terrible. The average Russian, if they needed a surgery, if they could even find a surgeon to do it, they had often to find medications, buy the medications, and bring to the hospital. Relatives had to provide food. There was no food within the hospital. Very primitive conditions. The healthcare system is slowly rebuilding. But many Russians are still nostalgic about the Soviet days. Not that it was on a par with the West, but during the Soviet days, especially by the 70s and 80s, there was essentially free healthcare, access to a general level of health care, doctors, hospitals, surgeries, and medicines. The lack of a good healthcare system has also contributed to the alcohol crisis in Russia. Until recently, the numbers are getting better, but when we first went there in the mid-2000s, the age at which men died on average, male mortality, was 60 years of age. Women were living on average to 72. It was one of the biggest gaps between men and women in the world. And that had a great deal to do with male abuse of alcohol for lots of reasons, losing jobs, sense of disorientation under the new regime. But also, if you don't have access to medicine and your body hurts, the best option is alcohol. So again, that's slowly improving, but it's been drug abuse, but even worse, the way alcohol ends up being used, and that has contributed, the high rates of alcohol use were contributing to these rates of male mortality. Yeah, Ted?
I wonder if you see any parallels when you talk about alcoholism and sort of conditions that reflect some despair in certain segments of the population, to a lot that's been written in the U.S. about deaths of despair, due to alcohol and opioid abuse and some of the economic conditions in both of the countries that have led to that kind of thing?
No, it's a very interesting question. You know, what contributes to the abuse of the body through alcohol, drugs, or other methods? Some people have argued that Russia is really a post-traumatic society. Now, I'm not a specialist on this, and I don't know how much you can use psychological categories that work on individuals to talk about an entire nation. But think about Russia's history over the last 100 years. We talked about 2 revolutions in the early 20th century. We talked about World War I, where the Russians had nearly 10 million casualties. Famine, the Stalin labor camps, perhaps taking another 20 million lives. World War II, 26 or 28 million Soviet deaths. One trauma after another. And then the traumatic transition to something after the Soviet Union, the sense of humiliation at losing so much of the Soviet Empire. The Central Asian republics became independent. The Baltic republics became independent. Belarus and Ukraine became independent. And this trauma, this sense of continuing trauma, despair, humiliation. So some people have observed that there is perhaps culturally in Russia right now something like a post-traumatic syndrome. And that then the abuse of alcohol is one element within that. But you know, every family's been touched by, they had a grandfather, they had a great uncle, they had a parent, somebody who was touched by one of these tragedies, one of these calamities. And it's so hard, you know, we Americans, again, I don't want to romanticize at all Russians, and there's nothing to defend about their aggressive behaviors. But when you compare their loss of 28 million citizens in World War II, how many soldiers did we lose? 400,000. And that was traumatic for our country. So it's hard to take it in. It's hard for me to get my head around it. You know, one of the funny things, strange things about Russia, you arrive in Moscow and it looks like the West. It looks like a big city. It looks like New York. It looks like Paris. It's got beautiful stores and wide boulevards. And at first you think, you know, I'm just in another version of the West. But behind that, there's a very different mentality. Yeah, John?
Picking up on that, I've been reading lately about post-traumatic greatness syndrome. this old idea about tough times make you stronger.
Yeah.
And I sense this in music from Russia and literature, even from the 19th century.
Right.
That there was this idea that we've been through hard times,
right,
but we are great. Is that true?
That's part of the national myth, identity, story. Exactly what you said. You find it in literature, you find it in music, that Russians have suffered, they've suffered unjustly, and yet through that suffering they've come out stronger.
So their literature and music, I sense, is much deeper than a lot of entertaining music.
The classics, I mean, you can find, of course, plenty of pop music too, but there is within the Russian, the way of telling their story, there is this claiming that, you know, we were put down by the Mongols, we were invaded by the French, we suffered under the Nazis, and yet we're a great people. And, you know, now think about this for a minute. What is our American strategy towards Russia right now? Because we think they're a bit too, you know, shoving and pushing with their elbows. So how are we going to demonstrate that they should get back into line?
Sanctions.
We'll punish them. We'll make them suffer. Is that going to work with Russians who say, well, that's what the Mongols did, that's what the French did, that's what the Nazis did? See, maybe it'll change Russian behavior, maybe it'll just deepen this national mythology. Well, of course we suffer. Russians always have to suffer. But that won't break us. And that's a very common attitude right now in Russia. When I talk to my friends and I say, how are the sanctions affecting you? What are you doing? You know, first of all, people will say, no, it's not having an effect. They don't want to talk about it. But the second thing they'll say, if you get deeper in the conversation, is we're used to suffering. Yes?
What do you have a whole perspective on their support to Syria and so on, and all the dynamic?
As I said, part of the dynamic has been that Russia traditionally has had influence in Syria. Going back to the Soviet period, there was Russian influence in Syria, in Egypt. Russia has been one of Assad's few allies in the last decade. And then there's also this element of Christianity, that Russia, part of its national mythology, is to be the defender of Orthodox Christianity. And you've had this historical Christian Orthodox presence in Syria. But I think, you know, putting all the identity politics aside, I think the other factor is, again, President Putin is a tactician. He's very good at not the long-term picture, but seeing where he can assert Russian interests in the short term. And he saw an opportunity in Syria. He saw a vacuum. He saw that the United States was not successfully, or not perhaps wanting to prosecute the war against Assad to a final victory over him. So there was a kind of stalemate in Syria. President Putin's always looking for an opportunity to say, here we are, you got to take us seriously. We're a world player. And I think he saw that opportunity in Syria. Yes?
Has the city of St. Petersburg benefited from the revitalization and modernization by Moscow?
I'm sorry?
The city of St. Petersburg.
St. Petersburg, okay.
I remember it being very drab, but like it was falling apart. Yeah.
So Moscow has benefited the greatest. Great deal of investment has gone into Moscow. And as I say, you would go there and it's a world-class city. This has been always a strategy within at least 100 years, also under the Soviet period. Lots of money was poured into Moscow. It was a showcase. The rest of the country was less prosperous. So, yes, you would still see a difference between Moscow and St. Petersburg. St. Petersburg has made a lot of progress, but you would immediately notice that people are not dressed as well. The metro is not as clean. The development has been slower. And then even more of a difference if you went out to a smaller provincial city, to the countryside. Yeah.
To follow up on that question of that thought, I mean, it seems to me like it feels like there are two Russias in a sense. But one consequence of those limited time zones is there's a need for a lot of infrastructure. And I've got to believe that, you know, over the years that's...
Yeah, that's an interesting, very good point. You know, what does it mean to live in such a huge country? Let's go back to the map. So, You know, this is really the most populated part of Russia, the Western European part. Then you have the Ural Mountains, and behind the Ural Mountains, that's about 9 time zones, you have Siberia. So this immense tract of Russia that is Siberia. Anybody want to guess how many people live in Siberia in those 9 time zones? 25 million people. It's minuscule.
How many are Russia?
I'm sorry?
How big is Russia population?
Oh, 140. 140. So 25 million in 9 time zones. That's where the resources are, the oil, the minerals, but still largely undeveloped. And so that's one answer to your question. There are two Russias in the sense that there's European Russia and there's the rest of Russia. And Siberia is still a bit like the, not the Wild West, but the West. It's less under the control of Moscow, except for the natural resources, but the way people live, the governance from Moscow is weaker. But notice, too, that there's this border. Now, Kazakhstan, that used to be a Soviet republic, but then you have this long border with Mongolia and China. How many people does China have?
Billions,
right? Billions of Chinese, 25 million Russians. What do you think Russians think about?
I want to build a wall.
Might be time to build a wall, right? Yeah, you see how geography can really affect the way you think. So Russians, given their national story of always being invaded, are waiting for the Chinese. Are, in many ways, China is the more immediate geopolitical threat than the United States. Okay, maybe one more question here. Yeah. Yes?
But this is kind of a minor. Is that all Siberia? That considered Siberia?
Everything behind the Ural Mountains is considered Siberia. All the, you know, just this little bit to the west is European Russia with the majority of the population. So Moscow, St. Petersburg, the larger cities. Yeah. So as I said, next week we're going to talk about religion. We're going to talk about the church. We're going to talk about the way that religion, Orthodox religion, has contributed to this story of national distinctiveness and greatness. And then the last week, 2 weeks from today, we will continue to talk about the rebirth of Orthodoxy. What is done in the way of drug rehabilitation, alcohol rehabilitation, feeding programs, religious education. So I invite you to come back. Look forward to more conversations. Thank you.
So, Orthodox? Is it Greek Orthodox?
So, yes. It's the same form of Christianity with icons and incense and the pageantry of the Orthodox tradition, but Orthodoxy is divided into different national forms of Orthodoxy. So there's a Greek Orthodox Church, an Antiochian Syrian Orthodox Church, a Russian Orthodox Church. They all share the same theology and many of the same practices of worship, but have these national cultural differences. All right, see you next week.